I'm Scott Kirzner, and I run the website cinematech.blogspot.com. I'm also working on a book about how new technologies are changing Hollywood. In January of 2006, I had a chance to sit down with Michael Rubin. He is an alumnus of Lucasfilm, where he helped introduce digital editing to the movie industry. He's also the author of the new book Droid Maker, George Lucas and the Digital Revolution, and his website is droidmaker.com.
So tell me a little bit about what you did when you were working at Lucasfilm in the 80s.
I thought I was going to be working on the Pixar image computer because I really was interested in sort of medical imaging, and they were doing this really cool 3D body stuff with the computer. But inexplicably, I ended up on the Editroid and the Soundroid projects, which were sort of the dawn of digital audio workstations and nonlinear editing tools. Sort of the product expert on these things. So if someone was doing a movie, I would go sort of make sure they were okay, help them with it. We were really inventing new sort of forms of post-production. And so trying to get these new tools to integrate into the Hollywood system of making a movie or a TV show was challenging. It's described as missionary work by a lot of people. And, you know,
what did people think? I mean, when you were demoing this, you know, this nonlinear editing technology at trade shows, how did movie editors and TV editors react initially?
Well, I think that it's, you know, you got to picture people who've been working in celluloid their entire lives walking up to a booth, and you've got the Star Wars music blasting, and there's a crowd out to the periphery, to the horizon. And here's a guy on this jet black curved console, the Editroid, we called it the Death Star console, and it's got a widescreen rear projection display and a Sun workstation, and I believe fear is probably the best way to describe a lot of, I mean, there's always those who were excited,
right.
And it definitely looked like the future.
But a lot of people worry, well, this is something new I'm going to have to learn, and I might not be as good at it.
I'm going to lose my job.
Uh-huh.
I'm never going to be able to figure this thing out. I was going to retire in 10 years now. What am I going to do? Do I have to learn something new for the last 5 years of my career? Can I hold out?
How did all these new technologies like nonlinear editing fit into the vision that George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola had about how they wanted to change filmmaking?
I think Francis and George both recognized that technology would be the thing that would liberate them from the clutches of the studio system. They had seen the sort of the way technology had created the French New Wave, or the New Wave in cinema in Europe, or the new lightweight cameras and portable sound things. And I think they believed that new technology would set them free. And they both desperately wanted to be free from Hollywood. Physically, they left L.A. and they moved up to the Bay Area, which was, of course, very cool and bohemian in '69.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the summer of love. And Francis sets up American Zoetrope, arguably the most technologically sophisticated facility in the United States at that time, certainly more so than anything in Hollywood. And Lucas, you know...
And did he have money from one of his pictures?
Well, you know, he did pretty well, you know. He was a successful writer. He was a successful director. He had broken into Hollywood where no film school student had, and it's sort of a classic story of him breaking in there. But almost immediately he's turning down jobs so that he could do the Rain People, so he can get a bunch of this lightweight cameras and go on the road with his friends, James Caan and Robert Duvall, and they go make a movie on the road, and George is on the road with them and watching closely what this experience is like. Now, Francis is incredibly charismatic. Lucas described him as, you know, he knows what the Caesars were like. When you see someone this charismatic, and everyone across the board describes Francis that way. So here you've got this gadget guy, Francis Coppola, who you know, president of the radio club in high school, right? And he really is painting a beautiful picture of the future, how they can do this stuff. And you've got George, who's very different from Francis. They have a terrific friendship. They both are compatible, even though they're very different. As far as their George really believes in editing. He's a gifted editor. He believes in the juxtaposition of pictures and sound, and he's a craftsman with tools for this stuff. And Francis is into human drama, and the two really inspired each other. And they both wanted to get away from Hollywood, and they both saw that technology could do it. Francis, I think, was clear that computers would be helpful here, and I think George probably picked up on that.
And there was the famous, I think you quoted it in your talk yesterday, I think it was a speech that Francis Coppola made at the Academy Awards, where people think of it as his fat girl speech, where I think there was some line about, you know, any fat girl in...
No. Okay, well, two different things. In 79, on the dais where he's handing the Oscar to Michael Cimino for The Deer Hunter, he launches into a little bit of a speech that kind of makes the audience uncomfortable, you know, the, like,
just hand him the award.
Sort of. Just hand him the award for crying out loud. And he sort of makes this really passionate little speech about how we're on the eve of a new technology revolution. This is 79. Mm-hmm. And it's a great speech. I have an excerpt from it in the book. What you're thinking of, however, is when he did Hearts of Darkness, the documentary on his making of Apocalypse Now. He ends, it's around the same time, mm-hmm. but it's a little bit later, where and I was moved by the comment, but it's like, someday, I think he says very unpolitic, a little fat girl in Ohio is going to make a beautiful film. She's going to mm-hmm. be the next, she's going to take her dad's camcorder and be the next Mozart. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of, for me, been my mantra, you know, both the inspiration from Lucasfilm as far as, you know, buildings, technology, and we're going to revolutionize the film industry. But Coppola, in a way, is the architect, you know, who painted this picture of like this little fat girl in Ohio being the next Mozart. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to spend my career helping people. You know, the tools are out there now. Apple makes these tools readily available. You can go buy a camcorder, and I don't know if people realize that these tools, there was a revolution and people died in the revolution to bring us these things, and now we have them, and all you need is a little bit of information on how to use it to make TV shows or movies or podcasts or whatever. It has been liberated, and it's just a little information what that 8-year-old in Ohio needs to know to make a movie, and I believe that Lucas is still passionate about that information being disseminated. It's not just for Hollywood and for him anymore. It's really about everybody. Mm-hmm. And there's that terrific quote from Lucas that was in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think, in 1970, where he prophetically says, you know, someday every kid is going to be able to make a movie, take mm-hmm. a camcorder and make a movie. That's 1970. That's before he was George Lucas Star Wars or George Lucas American Graffiti. And I find that a moving sort of dream that they had. And we're fortunate that he made Star Wars that made it possible for these things sort of to happen.
So your book, I think, wraps up around the time that kind of Pixar is spun out of Lucasfilm and kind of becomes its own independent company. You talk in the afterword, you talk a little bit about what's happened since then. But, I mean, today, what's interesting to you in the world of technology and cinema? I mean, kind of what do you think are the important things happening right now?
Well, I think that not only is the sort of the democratization important to me, because people all over the world can make films and communicate entertainment or news or whatever from their own personal vision, but the actual tools that Lucas uses to make Star Wars, for instance, that he's using the computer like a paintbrush, and he's a comic book artist, and he can actually take each frame and make each frame exactly the way he wants it. And, you know, I think personally, if he could do away with the actors, it's just a variable that you might not want to have. In a comic book, you make them do exactly what you want them to do.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of think that's, I don't think that's what he thinks of filmmaking, but that's what he has done in Star Wars. He paints each picture mm-hmm. the way he wants it. But by the creation of that tool, you can make your look at Sin City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rodriguez has actually made a comic book on the screen. I mean, he's pushed it even farther, but he's using the same tools. But my interest is when either a kid or a regular person or a budding filmmaker in some city makes a movie, and it's just a typical drama of people having a life, whatever, but you can still use the computer as a paintbrush to fix it up, to make it look better, mm-hmm. to make it look more professional, to add more people to a crowd so it helps tell your story better. So it's effects not in the sense of classical special effects, but really as a
kind
tool.
Of sweetener, really. You know, I'm only spending $10,000 on this movie, but it's going to look like I spent $1 million.
Yeah, I'm doing a small film, but to tell my story, I need to have this one thing happen. Her eye needs to twinkle, or her eye should be blue,
mm-hmm.
or I need a crowd scene, and I'm not going to get 50-100 extras, mm-hmm. but I can do it on a computer. To the end result of making a story that's better, you might want to use these tools in that way. And it's not the traditional science fiction epic use the way Hollywood uses the tools, because they're spending a ton of money and doing some really incredible things. But look at what was the movie, the Wedding Party, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
or you know, these films where you watch it's a beautiful little movie, and then you look at the credits and it's like, wow, look at all the CG people, you know, what special effects were in this movie. I mean, that's what I love, when you don't even realize it. And of course it blurs the line between animation and live action, because everything can be touched up. You can add a digital character all the way to the extreme of where Pixar is, where you can have all digital characters and mm-hmm. paint every frame. And
are you interested at all in kind of digital distribution, whether it's, you know, to an iPod or to a movie theater that has a digital projector? I mean, one thing that you hear a lot when you talk to people in Hollywood is, yeah, that's going to make our cost structure more affordable, but, you know, we don't think that all sorts of new filmmakers are going to be cropping up out of nowhere and making great movies. I mean, they kind of have this dismissive view, I think, towards...
They might be right. I mean, obviously when more people are making films, there's going to be more crap. I mean, that goes without saying.
Right.
But that's okay. Anyone can go get a canvas and a paintbrush and try to be Picasso, and most of them aren't. But if it makes one, if one little kid in Ohio ends up being Picasso, then it was worthwhile that there's lots of crappy stuff too.